I'm going to talk about gamma ray bursts, and I'm going to actually, I know many of you actually know more about the history and the observations than I do, but I'm going to go through them anyway, first for those that don't know the history of the observations, but secondly to give you the observations from the viewpoint of some guy that just works on the engine and doesn't really care about a lot of the details. So it's just an engine person's viewpoint of the observations, how the observations have changed what we do as trying to get an engine that actually works for gamma ray bursts. So I'll go fairly quickly through the history since there's already been some discussion of this before. In 1972, the Vega satellites discovered 16 bursts of gamma ray photons, and they quickly realized it wasn't the Russians testing nuclear weapons, so it ended up becoming something that it wasn't so quickly that it had to be out of our solar system, but it certainly the two favorite models became something like something that is in the galaxy or not in the galaxy. There was two classes, the ones with soft gamma ray repeaters, we've heard a lot on this, so I'm going to ignore them from now on, and I'll just talk about the classic gamma ray bursts. And the big battle was, were these bursts in the galaxy or were they in something that was occurring outside of the galaxy? The advantage of having them in the galaxy and why many people stuck with the galactic model for as long as they did was that the energy required to make a galactic burst, which is much closer to us, is much easier to produce than the energy required if the bursts are cosmological. And so they had a plan to send up a satellite to actually test this. The idea was, if they're in the galactic disk, they will be in the galactic disk, and you should see this if you just get an all-sky survey of this, or a most-sky survey of the bursts. And so they set up BATSE, and the first thing that BATSE, one of the first things BATSE helped us learn was that these bursts are isotropic, and here's not the most recent data, but it's, I mean, you're not going to get any more, but the basic punchline is that doesn't look like it's falling on the disk at all. And so for the engine theorist, you have to first give up the fact that they can be in the galactic disk. So you have two options now. Either they're in the galactic halo or they're cosmological. Interestingly enough, it sounded like when they were launching BATSE, this is just me reading the history, not being part of it, and you guys can maybe correct me if I'm wrong. It sounded like when BATSE went up, the two people argued that if they were isotropic, they would accept the cosmological model, and if they were in the disk, people would accept a galactic disk model. However, as soon as they became isotropic, theorists cleverly came up with models that were in the halo, and so you still had the galactic model, despite the fact that BATSE was produced.
Just a point on the history, by the way. they were known to be isotropic even prior to BATSE. What was the key?
Yeah.
Was that you saw the inhomogeneity, the spatial inhomogeneity.
Yeah.
That was the killer.
The log n log s, well, okay, I'm not going to go into that because the log n log s has various results. As the engine theorist, we don't take that as important a piece of information as the isotropy, only because you're starting to get into some funky statistics there. So at some point, BATSE also gave us some interesting things that, and I'm just going to go briefly over them. They had, the bursts had a lot of different profiles, and that was the other thing that, okay, maybe, now this is getting to a detail that we start worrying about as engine theorists, because this is starting to get more than we really care to try to model. We just try to get the energies that our people are seeing. But definitely there's a wide range of light curves of these bursts. And the thing that we actually clung to the most as engine theorists is the fact that it seems like the duration of the bursts are bimodal. So this is if you pick some kind of criterion for what the duration of the burst is, you can see that you get two kind of sets of bursts. And this has been argued whether this is real or not. Most of the engine theorists that I know believe it's real. It actually shows up a little to me a little better when you actually plot something like duration versus hardness ratio of the bursts. You see kind of some the short hard bursts and the long softer bursts, although you could also fit this with a line if you were clever. So the question is, are these two separate bursts? But I think most engine theorists and most people at this point see. Oh, the red ones, this was a paper from Tavani, I think, and he was trying to say that Beppo Sachs was most sensitive to the these harder bursts, these long duration harder bursts. I've been yelled at from Luigi, at least at some point, for saying that Beppo Sachs is most sensitive to the long hard bursts. And as you guys know, the Beppo Sachs team argues pretty strongly that they're also sensitive to short duration bursts. They just haven't seen any. So I'm not even sure this statement is true, but this is what we believed.
It's not actually that simple. They are sensitive, but they don't trigger.
Okay.
Because they don't look in this short.
Well, this is what I tried to argue with Luigi. He said, no, we would trigger, and I this is when I gave up understanding. All I know is that certainly Batsy and Beppo Sachs was not finding the short duration bursts at this point. But that gives me to Batsy, Beppo Sachs, which actually did the big thing that really convinced the theorists, those of us that still hated doing these high energies of cosmological. There's no way around it when you see something like the May 8th event, where you had these nice absorption lines and the burst spectra. And this is actually, I mean, to theorists, we always are surprised with these things that look kind of noisy that people call lines. But in fact, this is amazing data. So it's not like cosmologists who say they have a galaxy at redshift 4.5 where there's one line that they're looking at. There's a whole bunch of lines here. And just to, I mean, this I think is the best information, but they also, Dale Frail did some stuff with the radio where he looked at the twinkling of the radio and found that, and if you assume that the shock, this burst thing is expanding at the speed of light, at some point you would stop seeing the twinkling of the radio. And he did see an end to the twinkling after about 30 days of expansion. And that implies that he could estimate a distance. He knows what the angular size has to be for the twinkling to stop. He knows how fast it's expanding, roughly the speed of light, and so he can then estimate the distance. And that was consistent with this redshift determination of the May 8th event. But the redshift determination is probably the more believable. And what has happened since then is that they've kept on getting observations, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but they certainly got a range of bursts that, if you believe all the data, it seems like there's a range of bursts with a range of energies. Here's the December 14th event, had a redshift of 3.4, and it looked like it had, if you assume that the burst energy was isotropic, it had a 3 × 10⁵ burst. If you look at the April 25th event and assume that it's associated with the supernova that went off, it would predict a burst of just less than 10⁻⁷ erg. So it seems like there's even a range of burst energies. Although this is not, it may be just a range in the beaming of the bursts. So you have to be careful in how you interpret the results. But let's bear in mind, okay, I'm an engine theorist. I need at least a range of durations. It looks like they're double peaks. That might suggest two different mechanisms. It looks like there's a range in energies, or at least a range in something in the explosion mechanism. And there's a lot of structure that one might want to explain at some point. And certainly the theorists were busy with models all this time. So it wasn't like the theorists weren't working the whole time that the observers were making all this progress. They actually had a lot of models in the list. This is actually not even a recent list, and so the list was probably twice that. Yeah, 1993, so the list is actually maybe twice that size at this point.
But now the bursts outnumber the theories.
Yeah, that's, yes.
Yes, the bursts.
Yeah. The Batsy bursts outnumber the
theory. We couldn't keep up with one theory a day.
It's
publishing
it, that's the problem.
Well, now the theorists have a chance to catch up because we got rid of Batsy. What I want to talk about is a class of models that I think has kind of, it's becoming one of the favorites. When I make it a class, it's easy because I can just throw anything that seems at all likely into this class. But it has one thing in common, and that is it's powered by an accretion disk, a rapidly accreting disk around a black hole. And I like to call these the black hole accretion disks because then they're the bad GRB models. And this is kind of the class of all the favorite ones. This is a plot that Max Ruffert made. This is a weird thing with credit in gamma ray bursts. Max Ruffert made this plot and actually is the first one to actually put all of these five together, but he gives credit, and I've deleted it from the text that's down there. He gives credit to Stan Woosley at a Ringberg meeting that was even before we had come up with some of these mechanisms. So it's a weird way of giving credit because Max should have just given credit to himself. So this is Max Ruffert doing this kind of tying this class together. The class includes two neutron stars merging. This is a double neutron star model. This has actually been the favorite for a while. Holst-Taylor pulsar, you have an example of something that's going to merge, so you know it exists. And when you have it merge, it ends up forming, well, the difficulty here is depending on your equation of state, when it merges, it may well collapse to a black hole. And if it does collapse to a black hole, it also produces a 0.01 to 0.1 solar mass torus around the black hole that's so close to the black hole that it'll accrete on the order of 10 millisecond timescales. There is also the black hole neutron star merger model, which is essentially the same. You have a black hole and a neutron star. The neutron star merges. It forms an accretion disk around the black hole, usually a 0.1 solar mass torus after all is said and done. That will accrete on the 10 millisecond timescale and make a short gamma ray burst. And then there's a bunch of models that were the long duration gamma ray burst models. Probably the favorite is the collapsar model, which is also sometimes called the hypernova model. What it is imagine you have a very massive star. That massive star is rotating, and when it collapses, it's unable to drive a supernova explosion. So it just collapses directly to a black hole. Because the massive star has angular momentum, the matter in the polar region will accrete very quickly, but the matter in the equator will build up in a disk. And so you can imagine this disk then powering a gamma ray burst in the same, and I'm going to go through the mechanism how you might power a gamma ray burst with a rapidly rotating, with a black hole with a rapidly accreting disk around it in a few minutes. But you can still get the same kind of conditions where you have an accretion disk around a black hole. Another model that we came up with was imagine you have a neutron star or a black hole spiral into the center of a star in a common envelope phase. When it reaches the center of the helium core, it will have spun up the helium core, so it'll look like a rotating helium core, which is not much different than the collapsar model, which was a rotating massive star. So you have essentially a rotating helium core with a black hole in the center. And the last, which I find to be probably the least pleasing, is the black hole white dwarf merger model, where you have a black hole and a white dwarf. This one's more of a long duration burst because the white dwarf gets torn up so much further out than, say, a black hole neutron star merger that it actually has a lot of angular momentum and takes longer to accrete. But you again get, you know, you get roughly a solar mass of material in this disk that then accretes onto the black hole. So it's also a possible gamma ray burst model.
How well do you know those
limits
for the torus masses?
I'll show you some simulations, but these are all based on simulations, so they're pretty, I mean, it's not going to change by more than a factor of 2. So I give you an error. Actually, here I have an error bar factor of 10. That depends on what you assume for your neutron stars when they're merging, but it's not going to be any different than a factor of 10. And you know essentially where this occurs, how much angular momentum, because you know when the neutron star starts getting disrupted. So it's not going to change much more than these kind of errors. Like when I say 0.1, it's not going to be lower, less than 0.01 for this case, and it's probably going to be between 0.5 and 2. 0.05 and 0.2. The problem with a lot of these models is you don't even know we don't know how fast stars are rotating. So this model, you don't even know it will exist. You don't know if you can make a massive star rotating fast enough. So there's a lot of problems in trying to make these models. what happens when you get an accretion disk?
Excuse me, is that failed supernova failed because of rotation? What is it? Is it called?
The assumption that it is that it's failed because it's a very massive star. And the very massive stars, you have this big ram pressure that you're trying to overcome, and it's harder to do it. So it's just the standard.
I said the star should be harder.
Well, this is where we disagree. When I say we, me and Stan and other people, it's not really clear we can tell from core collapse supernova simulations. But 40, it's not. There's a range where you form black holes, but you still get a supernova explosion. And that's probably between 25 and 40 solar masses. So it would have to be beyond 40 solar masses where you don't get a supernova explosion whatsoever. I don't know. It's not even clear to me, because the problem is, as you get more massive, you're likely to have bigger winds. And so you may not even get black holes when you go more massive. So it's not even clear that any star actually collapses directly to a black hole. You don't need that to explain the black hole observations, because those can be in systems where you actually got a supernova explosion, but then you had enough fallback to make a black hole. So, and that's probably, most of the black holes in the universe are probably these fallback black holes. So it's not even clear that you get any of these direct collapse failed supernova. There's a variant on this is, can make fun of Stan because this is being recorded. Stan has now variants of this collapsar model. He calls them different types. So the collapsar type 1 is what I described. You have a helium star that collapses. It's a massive star collapsing to form a black hole with an accretion disk. You can have, he calls it a collapsar type 2, which is you have a supernova explosion, but your fallback is rapid enough that it forms has a high enough accretion rate that you might get a gamma ray burst. But now we're really hand-waving, because the fallback really isn't understood that well, so it's not clear you can get rapid enough accretion rates. But you can imagine a situation where you have a very weak explosion, say 0.5 or 0.2 times 10 to the 51 ergs, so about a tenth of normal supernova or a fifth of normal supernova, and you get a weak supernova explosion, and then you can have a lot of fallback and form something that's like a collapsar, which Stan calls a collapsar type 2. This is partially because we can't get these direct. It seems hard to get these direct collapsars. So it's hard to get something that fails completely. It seems like we often get supernova explosions. So the question is, how can we somehow get these exploding, these stars not to explode? If we can't do that, then we have to go to the collapsar type 2s. But then once you form this accretion disk around the black hole, there's actually two different mechanisms to form your gamma ray burst. One is you have this accretion disk. This accretion disk will emit a whole bunch of neutrinos, especially right near the last stable orbit. So this is a few times the last stable orbit. It gets really hot because it's accreting at something like 1 solar mass per second, or 0.1 solar mass per second. The density and temperature in this area is very high, and the neutrino emission rate is also huge. It's on the order of 10 to the 51 and greater, 10 to the 52, 10 to the 53 ergs per second. These neutrinos will annihilate, and preferentially actually right along the pole, they'll annihilate against each other. So neutrino, anti-neutrino annihilation will form a whole bunch of electron-positron pairs in a kind of pair plasma. So you have photons, electron-positrons in a plasma, which is going to be our jet. This is the jet. It's the annihilation energy from the neutrinos. And we've done little calculations where we take various alpha disks. Bob Poffin ran a series of alpha disks, and then we calculated what's the neutrino annihilation rate and where is it occurring. So what I have here is a fairly confusing plot. The total luminosity in ergs per second for the from neutrino annihilation. So it's for a model where the alpha is 0.1, this is an accretion rate of 0.1 solar mass per second, and rotation of the black hole of 0.5, which is fairly realistic for our model, we get almost 10 to the 50 ergs. This is on this plot, this is 10 to the 47, 10 to the 48, 10 to the 49, 10 to the 50 ergs per second of luminosity in neutrino annihilation. So if it went on for 10 seconds, you'd get 10 to the 51 ergs in the burst. The temperatures, they're above, they're probably on the order of 5 MeV. So, and the annihilation occurs, this is going out in from the disk, so if I go out in radius from the disk, so one of the questions is, where is this energy getting deposited? If I go out in radius from the disk, so I'm looking essentially above this plane and going out in radius, where is the energy getting deposited? It's preferentially almost right above the pole. So here's the peak. This is the radiate as I go out in the disk, and this is the peak luminosity. So around 10 kilometers is where most of the energy is getting deposited. You get essentially almost 50% out at around 30 kilometers. So most of this energy is getting deposited right here in the disk, you know, in this kind of area. And that's going to be what drives the jet that makes the gamma ray burst. Then questions come of how can you beam it? Can you beam this energy even more? It's slightly beamed from neutrino annihilation, but is there some way to beam it? And the advantage of the collapsar model and the helium merger model is you still have quite a bit of material up in the star that can actually pressure beam this jet. And I should have gotten a plot of this. Ewald Muller did a simulation, a relativistic simulation, where he put a star and actually just injected this energy. So he didn't model the disk formation, but he just said, here's my star, I'm going to inject energy along the axis. And he calculated how beamed it would be. And he gets quite high beamings, like 1% and less in beaming of the jet. So it's what we kind of predict for the collapsar and the helium merger model is that you'll get very beamed jets. The advantage of doing this is that you need less energy, because in most of the model where they say they observe 3 times 10 to the 53 ergs, this is assuming that the burst was isotropic. But if it's beamed into 1% of the sky, you only need 3 times 10 to the 51 ergs to explain the observation. You just have to have it now pointing toward you. So you have to have more bursts, but you don't have to have as much energy in the bursts.
Do you get a lot of baryon entrainment?
So that's the thing that you have to worry about. The advantage of most of these things, the reason you use a disk accretion, is that there's less baryons in that in the polar region. And I think there's well, at least Ewald's latest simulation, and the way you can check the baryon entrainment is what is the gammas of the stuff that you're ejecting. And he had a relativistic code. And I think his latest simulation, he could get gammas of 10. So we're still an order of magnitude less than what you need to make the burst.
Is he putting in the charge current absorption?
What?
Is he putting in the charge current absorption?
So the photons or
neutrinos. On the free nucleons.
At some point, we calculated that to see how much it was, and we don't have it in, but we calculated it, and I can't. I mean, the result was that it wasn't that important. It wasn't going to slow it down too much. So that was the concern. I guess the concern you have is that the neutrinos will actually slow down the jet. And at least that's what we were checking for. And we found that it wasn't big enough to slow down the jet.
I mean, blow matter off the surface of the torus.
Okay. That's not included in Ewald's simulation. That's included in most of the simulations that I'll show some plots of. And that ejecta is usually on the order of 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 4. But that's where you have to worry about. You also have that stuff blowing out. So can your jet kind of push that stuff around so it's not entraining too much of it? That's one of the problems.
So how long does it take for this disk to form? Because you said it
already
increased very quickly.
Oh, so yeah. So it forms. I mean, the neutron star mergers, you essentially have the merger occurs in a few orbits. You know, and when the merger occurs, it collapses to a black hole, and that the disk is forming while it's collapsing to a black hole. And the same with the collapsar. Within a second of the collapse itself, so you form the black hole, and your black hole is maybe 2.5 solar masses, and now I have a disk because the angular momentum in the material is slowed down. So you have a few seconds at most where the disk is formed and accretes.
But it has enough time to settle down into the thing.
Well, okay, I'll show you what the disks look like. Just quickly, once you get, well, I won't go through the actual fireball mechanism. It's for the engine people, we generally don't worry about. We just try to get the gammas that the fireball people tell us to do, and I'll just, I guess, show you. So again, this is for the engine people. We talk mostly to the intermediary theorists that help us to understand the observations. So there's people like Martin Rees and Peter Mazaros who have this fireball model that tells us if we can get a jet with this kind of gamma, with this much energy, you know, and this much baryon contamination, if we can get something like this, they tell us whether they can explain the observations. And this is the fireball model for gamma ray bursts. You have this jet that goes out. It's optically thick to itself, so it kind of just expands outward. At some point, it gets, so it actually cools off, but then you have shocks within, and the current model now, at least the current last I heard, was it's shocks within the ejected material. It used to be that it was shocks with the ISM, but then they said, well, let's have the shocks with itself. So the material, the jet's going out and it has shocks with itself. So imagine you have slightly different pulses of material coming out. You can get shocks of the jet material with itself, and that can create the burst of gamma rays. The advantage that the model has is if you assume that your jet is coming out toward you at a very, very relativistically, so at a very high Lorentz factor gamma, you can actually explain the gamma ray burst. And I think this fireball model, funnily enough, I had a referee who was not a gamma ray burst person on a paper that I was doing actually dislike this whole fireball model. They thought it was hokey. But I think this fireball model actually is pretty well accepted, and it seems to work. Someone can tell me if there's very many detractors anymore, but I think the basic idea of the fireball model is seems to work fairly well, and it seems to have matched a lot of the observations. So we assume it's real, and we just take there what they tell us. Then is you need this much energy with this little mass so that you can get high enough relativistic velocities to explain the observations, and that's what we're looking for in our engines. So people do simulations of these, and here's a simulation of a double neutron star merger. And generally what you have to do these simulations, this is density at different times. This is 1 millisecond, 2.5 milliseconds, 5 milliseconds. So in the case of the double neutron star merger, it takes you roughly 5 milliseconds to form your disk. This is what people put into their codes at this point is an equation of state that is reasonably, this is developed by Jim Latimer and Doug Svesty. So it's equation of state that should be modeling these dense regimes. They have some way of letting the neutrinos leak out. In this case, they use a neutrino leakage scheme, which just allows those neutrinos that were within some optical depth of the neutron star to just flow out. And then they just model in some hydrodynamic technique. In this case, it's a piecewise parabolic method. And model the star, but this has been done by people using a variety of different techniques, and some people are even adding. In their case, they put it in a Paczynski-Vita potential and just model the merger. People have been doing post-Newtonian calculations as well. I'm not sure how much that really changes the basic result. It doesn't seem to change it too much. The biggest argument and uncertainty in this thing is you merge two 1.4 solar mass neutron stars, and there's at least some people that still claim that with the rotation velocity that these neutron stars will have, so now you have a 2.7 solar mass core, but it's still very hot and it's rotating very rapidly. Would that collapse to a black hole? I think most people think it will, but Fred Razio is certainly someone that does not believe that. So the question is, will this collapse quickly to a black hole, or will it need to cool down and spin down before it does? So there's kind of options on what really happens with the double neutron star mergers. And then I'll just go through these quickly. This is a plot of a black hole neutron star merger, and again things happen fairly quickly. It starts accreting over at 2.4 milliseconds in the simulation. By 17 milliseconds, you have essentially your accretion disk and your black hole. One thing to note, and this is I found that this was surprising that people one thing that you might want to have is accretion not to be a steady state. This will not give you steady state accretion. So maybe some of that, you know, this may be the down-home cause of the range and, you know, the variation in the emission. If you have something like this where you're accreting actually blobs, you're not accreting some smooth disk. So it's not clear. You may get some of this fine structure with this, but no one's done any studies of that. We're not really at that level.
How sensitive are your results to the neutron star equation state?
That's a good question. Most people, well, okay, there's some people have tried different equation states where they use different gammas. And when they do that, they can get a range of results. As far as how much of a disk do you produce and stuff like this, it's not going to change the result too much.
But does it matter if you have a 6 radius? Soft equation state or a hard equation state?
Well, so the problem is that the people that have used more realistic equations of state have all used this Sesti-Latimer equation of state with only a few variations in the binding energy, kind of the symmetry energy. So it's not, they haven't really tested the full range of soft and hard equations of state. It hasn't been tested on a lot of different equations of state. There's not really that many equations of state you can throw in and try, other than using different gamma laws, which are sometimes not as realistic.
But can you comment on the issue, though, of gamma is, as I understood it, was more of, for some gammas, when you lose mass, the radius increases, and for other gammas, I forgot the critical gamma, the inverse is true, namely when you lose mass, the radius decreases, there's a critical gamma. And so my understanding was that really did make a big difference in the stability, the rapidity of the mass transfer.
I mean, I think you can push it to a region where you actually get it so that it doesn't accrete very quickly. But the problem is that you can do a nice little analytic solution where you can say it's a big effect by doing the following. If you say when I accrete matter onto the black hole, angular momentum is conserved, that would tell you that as your neutron star accretes onto the black hole, the thing should widen by angular momentum conservation if the orbital angular momentum is conserved. But the orbital angular momentum is not conserved. A lot of it goes into the disk angular momentum. This is not like a big star accreting. The disk is at essentially the same radius as the star that's getting disrupted, and so it can hold a lot of the angular momentum, and it probably holds most of it as you accrete onto the black hole. So you actually do not conserve orbital angular momentum. You conserve total angular momentum, but not orbital angular momentum. And then I think it's unless you push things to the extreme, you can't delay this accretion very much. So I think the person that was pushing it to the most extreme was William Lee. And I think at least the latest results I saw from him, it can change this by a factor of 2 or 3, but not much more. And I actually think he's pushing it to an extreme, which will not occur generally. But these things can change. So you also have what will general relativity doing general relativity more accurately change this result as well.
For the equation of state, even Latin West it doesn't make sense if you don't have GR. If you take just the spherically symmetric neutron star with any equation of state, it's completely wrong if you don't have GR.
Yeah, so the question is
how is not better than polytron.
Well, I mean, you can, yeah, I've heard, I mean,
the basic equation is wrong anyway, so even the equation that is right, you get the wrong result.
I mean, this is also a question with core collapse supernova. If we had stuck with gamma law equations of state, we would not be struggling with them at the moment because they would all explode. The problem is we started using more accurate equations of state, which can only cause trouble. But without GR.
Without GR, almost had a heart attack when using the equation.
The other thing that people have done is collapsars, and so here's a collapsar simulation. It's 2D simulation by Andrew McFadden, and what happens is he lets it accrete for about a second or so, and what happens, so he lets the star collapse for about a second or so, and what he ends up producing is, this is density, colored density, so red is high, blue is low, and what he ends up producing, and this is entirely sensitive on the angular momentum profile he gave to his star, he produces some kind of disk with the hollowed out hole. And so the argument there was, you have a disk now, I'm going to get neutrino annihilation mostly in here, and it's going to drive a jet So he calculated this accretion disk, then looked at the work by Bob Poffman and said, okay, this is the accretion rate I have. What would be the neutrino annihilation energy deposited because of this? So he looked that up in Bob Poffman's work and then inputted it into his star. So he started adding the energy into the star from the neutrino annihilation rates from Bob Poffman. And then he produced his jet. And what he found is his code was actually non-special relativistic, so he quickly got jets that were going faster than the speed of light. But this is actually the input that he gave to Ewald Mueller to then calculate it in a relativistic code and get a solution for the jet that is getting the 10, the gammas of 10, which is still an order of magnitude away from what we need. And so neutrino annihilation is one way to do this. The other way is magnetic fields. The problem is that magnetic fields, it's the same. It's the AGN mechanism. Essentially, we assume it's the AGN mechanism, but we change it to the densities of our disk and the accretion rates of our disk. And people have done extrapolations and found that you can get quite a bit of energy. So, but since the AGN mechanism isn't really solved yet, it's even scarier to then extrapolate from it when you don't really understand it completely. And so whenever we do calculations, we tend to do neutrino annihilation only because we can make a number that's probably within a factor of 10 or 20 or 100 of the right answer, whereas I don't think we can do that with the magnetic field mechanisms. Interestingly enough, Andrew found that if you looked at his accretion rate, and before you get upset, let me qualify, he actually found that he put in the accretion rate and then calculated a neutrino annihilation rate, and he found big variations in how much energy was coming from the neutrino annihilation. And I personally believe that this is an artifact of low-resolution simulation, but they actually found that if they took a power spectrum of this, it corresponded to a frequency that was roughly the frequency of the outer portion of this accretion disk. So he was arguing that there was some kind of weird interaction physically happening along here with the accretion rate onto the disk that caused this variation in the accretion rate.
I can understand. When you say frequency that corresponds to this outer disk, what frequency?
So if you take a circular, it's essentially a dynamical time scale. I just wanted to put that up.
Dominated by the inner part.
What? The energy is dominated by the inner part, but the accretion rate is actually a function of how much are you throwing stuff onto the outer part of the disk, because then that pushes the material in through the...
But you're going to remember that at the inner part of the disk?
I just wanted to show this. I actually don't think... you can remember. If you put in the accretion, one thing you can play with a given alpha, if you change the accretion rate onto the outside of the disk, that changes the accretion rate going through, and so you can play with that, and so on. You can easily construct a toy model where you change the accretion rate onto the disk, and that will change the accretion rate through the disk, and you can play with that. Whether that, whether this is real or just an artifact is a different question. Certainly, you can devise something like Bob Poffman can create something where he changes the accretion rate on the outer part of the disk, and gets a different. We can get a different luminosity as we go through. So you can actually get that. But whether that has any, whether that is what we're seeing here is another question. And they actually haven't, to my knowledge, run a higher resolution run just to see if it went away or not.
But this was on the orbital time of the outer part of the disk.
Yeah, I found that a little funky, I don't think they even believe it. That I don't even think they believe it that much. But this is why they still put it into their paper. Yeah. But the point is that there are little effects that can cause. It wouldn't take much to cause this little detail. So it's not something that's impossible to have. And one there's.
But the only way to get that out then is you've already cleared your hole. So you can actually see that in the jet.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm producing a jet, and I'm producing slightly different gammas as a function of time.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, okay.
So the gamma of my jet oscillates,
okay.
And that will then maybe cause structure in the fireball later on. It doesn't have to match what you see, but these different gammas, if you could give a jet that had different gammas as a function of time, there would be more internal shocks, and that would be a way to explain internal shocks. people liked the supernova, this collapse star model, primarily because of what really got it into the headlines was, I think, this 1998 BW GRB 980425 coincidence. You have a weird supernova and a gamma ray burst, and they're roughly in the same place at the same time. And the collapsar model itself predicted that after you drive the jet, you actually explode the star some as well. So they, when they ran the simulation out to late times, this is not late enough, this explosion actually wraps around and ejects a lot of the disk. So this explosion, there's some ejecta all along here, and at very late times, they get ejecta essentially in a kind of supernova explosion that follows the gamma ray burst. And so they predicted that there would be a supernova following a gamma ray burst, predicted after, well, the paper came out after the observation, but they actually believed this. The problem was that Andrew was having trouble writing his paper, so he actually had all these results a year before this observation came out. He just didn't get the paper submitted before that time, which is kind of tragic. But so this kind of says, oh, wow, look at this. This is what the collapsar model says. It seems to work. There's some more evidence if you look at gamma ray burst 980326. It seems like there's some follow-up. There's been arguments that there's supernova correlated with gamma ray bursts. It would be a good thing. I mean, one way to kill some of these models, the collapsar and the helium merger, is we do need some kind of ejecta in the, if Andrew's models are right, we should be getting ejecta in the equatorial region as well, just going at a much slower velocity. So it's not going to produce a gamma ray burst, but it should produce something that looks like a supernova. If this doesn't happen, I think that's bad for both the helium merger and the gamma ray burst, the collapsar models. Oh yeah, that's right. So there's three now. So it looks pretty.
There's some people claiming this one more.
And we've also done simulations now of, this is Weichen Zhang in Santa Cruz, has done simulations of helium merger models where he takes, this is a two solar mass black hole, puts it within the Rose lobe, lets Rose lobe accretion occur. This really drives it, drives the neutron star into the center of the helium star. This is a, I think in this case, an 8 solar mass helium star. It goes into the center, and you suddenly get this kind of rotating helium blob with a black hole in the center, and it accretes at a rapid rate. So we could then calculate the accretion onto it. Here's kind of the accretion rate versus time for a 16 solar mass helium star and a 2 solar mass neutron star. So we did a simulation where we let this thing fall in, and you see that you have an accretion rate that's going up to 0.06 solar masses per second. If you calculate the luminosity for the spin period of this black hole, this is a rapidly spinning black hole, by the time that it gets into the center, you can actually calculate the luminosity of neutrino annihilation, and it gets up almost to 10 to the 51 ergs per second for a brief time, and then it goes down. This is a log plot, so it was a big, actually most of the energy occurs right in this time, so this is when the burst would explode. So you see structure here as well, but this I know for a fact, since I was hoping we'd turn with the simulations, is entirely artifact of resolution. So at least this result, I know what the answer is. It's a resolution artifact. But it's a mess in there, so it's not surprising that you would have some kind of range in accretion rates. It's not some spherically symmetric object at the end. It's a mess, and that's going to make a mess in the disk.
How can you accrete so much helium in such a short time?
It's just if you calculate the time that it would take the material to fall in, that's just that accretion rate. So it's not Bondi-Hoyle, because we essentially, what we assumed at some point is you have to have a viscosity. So we know what our viscosity is. In this case, we assume that the viscosity is, well, the viscosity was roughly 0.1, alpha equal 0.1 with an alpha disk. And we just say how quickly does this matter fall in? But if you looked at just the Bondi-Hoyle accretion rate of a helium star in the center of a helium core, its accretion rate is really high. If you just took an object and put it into the center of the helium core of a massive star, the accretion rate would be on the order of 0.1 solar masses per second. So it's just the Bondi accretion rate would tell you it's going to be high, 0.1 solar masses per second.
Helium would be extremely dense then.
It is dense and it burns when it can. And in most of the cases, it burns in the disk. The material it falls into the potential well and then burns in the disk. But that burning doesn't hold it up. It's too far in the potential well for it to hold it up.
Now, models like this explain the energetics.
What?
The energetics of the gamma ray burst, these things explain.
Yeah, so the object would be, then you get this accretion rate, and then if you assume neutrino annihilation was working, and we really were kind of overestimating, then you can calculate what the neutrino annihilation deposition is, and in this case, it could get as high as 10 to the 52 ergs.
Yeah, but now, those models, do they explain the observational details like afterglow?
So the afterglow is explained if you get this jet that drives the fireball.
But these models, do they produce jets?
They produce the jet. This is what will produce a jet. Then the fireball model people say we can explain the afterglow with a jet like this.
Clapsar model is not the only one.
Clapsar model is not the only one.
So all these models produce jets and the fireball.
Yeah, it's likely that the neutron star mergers and neutron star black hole mergers are less beamed than the Clapsar model, unless the mechanism is magnetic fields. If it's a magnetic field mechanism to make the jets. Yeah, they all produce fireballs. How much time do I have? Okay, so I'll just cover, I thought it would be fun to at least show how this ties into neutron stars. And so I'm going to show one of these horrible formation scenario plots, which actually, I like them. This is why you start using them. But this will be some of the, I'll kind of show, this is, there's a lot of formation mechanisms for these objects. So at some point I did this paper where I tried to list as many as I could. And for these five classes of models, we came up with something like, 13 different formation scenarios. So most of these things can be formed in three different ways. And so there's a lot of different ways to form these. And I'm just going to show three formation mechanisms for three different gamma ray burst progenitors. Imagine you have two massive stars, both O stars, both likely to collapse to neutron stars when they end their lives. You generally, if they're close enough in separation, when the more massive star goes into its off the main sequence, you'll get mass transfer. Let's imagine. Again, every step along the way, there's a huge number of uncertainties. Imagine you go through this mass transfer, but the more massive star remains the more massive star, so it collapses first. If it gets a large kick, the binary is disrupted. This is no longer not so interesting to people doing gamma ray bursts. But you can form a high velocity. If it has a large kick velocity in the neutron star and the supernova explosion mechanism, then you can form yourself a fast pulsar. If it has a small enough kick velocity, and this depends on the direction of the kick velocity and all of these details, you'll remain bound. And at some point, the secondary will evolve off the main sequence, in which case you'll go through another mass transfer phase. Let's imagine that the mass transfer phase goes into a common envelope. Then you have several options. So my primary has formed a neutron star. My secondary is off the main sequence. You go into a common envelope phase where the primary neutron star is in the hydrogen envelope of the secondary star. It's spiraling around. If it merges with the helium core, it will merge all the way to the bottom, and this will be a helium merger gamma ray burst. So when I say helium merger gamma ray burst, that's kind of the standard mechanism for forming it. If it ejects the hydrogen envelope, then you now have a neutron star you have a compact object and a helium core. And when the helium core collapses, if it gets a high kick, you can form two high velocity compact objects. But if it's a low enough kick that they remain bound, if there wasn't much accretion in the common envelope phase, you'll form a double neutron star binary, if there was a lot of accretion in the common envelope phase, you'll form a black hole neutron star binary. And this is probably the biggest fight right now one of the big fights in binary population synthesis is how much accretion does it get in this common envelope phase if it rejects the hydrogen envelope. And the problem is it's not just a function of how much is it, what rate is it accreting in this hydrogen envelope, it's how long does it take it to eject this hydrogen envelope and what are the densities around it. And so it could go either way, and there's not really one solution or the other. I can tell you for sure that if it goes into the helium core, the accretion rate is high enough that I know it'll collapse into a black hole and form this. But I do not know what will happen if it's in just a hydrogen common envelope phase. If it spirals down very close to the center and has a high accretion rate, so right to the surface of the helium star, it's likely to become a black hole. But if it doesn't, it'll probably form a neutron star. So you can form, here's in one slide, you can see three different mechanisms for forming neutron star binaries, neutron star black hole binaries, and helium mergers. The neutron star black hole binaries, I should say, this is one mechanism for forming neutron star black hole binaries. If you assume all systems that go into this common envelope phase and do not merge with the helium core form neutron star black hole binaries, this will be the dominant formation scenario for neutron star black hole binaries. And it'll form a lot of them. So this would be most of the gamma ray bursts. But the question is, we don't know enough about the details to really know these answers. So generally, you have to just play with population synthesis and do a lot of simulations. And we've actually done a lot of simulations where we played with all the free parameters that you have, and you can then calculate rates. And I'll just give you the kind of at some point the rates are this is me trying to be optimistic on the rates, and what I did is a formation rate of gamma ray bursts per day. So I folded this into the star formation history of the universe, which is another uncertainty. So there's about 1,000 uncertainties in this calculation, all that have order of magnitude effects. And then I tried to convince myself of what would I, these rates that I give here, what would I be willing to bet on even odds that at least three of the five, over half of the rates are correct, and these are my rates. So I would say that, well, that's cheating, because this one I put a little less than sign, which means that I'm probably right, because I picked a huge rate up here. So at least, I would say, well, at least two of the four are, so this one we know is right, because I have a less than sign, but the other, I would say at least two of the other four are correct as well. There's just a lot of uncertainties. And so this black hole neutron star rate, it's really high if I let a lot of neutron stars spiral in and accrete and form black holes. So this, I think, it can form up to 1,200 gamma ray bursts per day. I guess the common question I get is, what rate should you have? Because you see maybe one gamma ray burst per day, and then the question is, why am I ecstatic by getting higher rates like 1,200 per day? Well, the problem is they're beamed. So if they're beamed at 1% of the sky, I need I need more than 100 per day to explain the observations in the universe. So these are kind of rough rates. This is the only one that I think is kind of too small to be interesting. But Belchinsky and Bullock have said, well, what about white dwarf neutron star binaries? If you're really powering gamma ray bursts with magnetic fields instead of neutrino annihilation, the merger of these things might form gamma ray bursts, and if so, the rate of white dwarf neutron star mergers is much higher than white dwarf black holes, and they actually get rates that are on the order of the black hole neutron star rates for white dwarf neutron star binaries. So these can actually be play a big role as well. The thing that I really think you can study with binary population synthesis is things like how far will these objects move from their host galaxy and questions like that. And just to quickly show you.
But those also have predictions for LIGO. I mean, you'd also run into, at what point do you make, some of those numbers are detectable by LIGO 1.
Actually, none of these really are. Oops, sorry.
No, I don't believe so. 1,200 per day, I bet it's detectable.
1,200 per day is something like 10 to the minus 5 per year per galaxy. So that's too low for LIGO 1. That's high enough for LIGO 2.
one per million years per galaxy.
Yeah, so 1,200
per day is 1 per 10. Well, this depends on what you choose for your star formation rate. And okay, I should say, maybe I have my supernova rate. I chose something like this for my supernova rate, merger rate per day. The problem is that whenever I show this plot, this is the Madal plot, but plotted in per day rather than per day per megaparsec cubed. So this black line is the kind of Madal plot where you go up and then go flat. And this is if you go up and go down with the star formation rate. And these things are, again, another uncertainty, and I don't think they're really known that well. What I've done here is actually plotted what would be this, because one interesting thing you can look at is where the slopes of the merger rates for the dual double neutron stars and the black hole neutron stars as a function of redshift. And it depends. These different colored lines are using different parameters in the population synthesis code. And there's some change in the slope here, and so some change in the distribution. But if you were arguing of whether the star formation rate goes up and goes flat, or goes up to at a redshift of 1.5 and then starts turning down again at some higher redshift, you can actually tell the difference between those two, even with all these uncertainties in the binary population synthesis. So one thing that the binary population synthesis can do is give you some handle on the star formation rate if you had a whole bunch of gamma ray bursts observed with the redshifts. You could then actually use the distribution to place some constraints on the star formation history of the universe. And I guess just for the last thing, the thing that people have really used is what are the distribution of these gamma ray bursts in their host galaxy, and if the collapsar model, the helium merger model, all will have their bursts inside the host galaxy. The double neutron star and the black hole neutron star model will have kicks, and some of their objects will get outside of the host galaxy. For the Milky Way, not very many objects will go beyond 100 kiloparsecs. And again, it depends on whatever population synthesis parameters you've chosen. But if you go for very low mass galaxies, like 1/4 the mass of the Milky Way, there should be quite a few that are outside of their host galaxy. And this is where people have done some calculation. I guess Josh Bloom did the latest, where they said, let's try and, well, here's what I did at some point. I said, where are the gamma ray bursts that are observed? This was back when we were trying to finish up our paper. There was just these four gamma ray bursts that were all observed here. And the black hole neutron star and the double neutron star merger distances from their host galaxy seem much further than what we were predicting with our population synthesis, even if we did a range of different population synthesis calculations. And Josh Bloom has done this a little more with more statistics, so pushed the statistics quite far. He has double neutron star and black hole neutron star gamma ray bursts with respect to the observations, and this plot does not fit this one very much. And so if you look at your KS test, you see that the chances are that this is not maybe the but it's very unlikely that this could be the right fit. And it looks like there's a better fit with the helium merger collapsar gamma ray bursts with the observations. And I think he had like 12 or 13 gamma ray bursts, maybe more. But he had quite a few more gamma ray bursts in his sample. I think this question's still out. What would be interesting to see is that if we get short duration bursts, which most of the engine mechanism people believe to be gamma ray bursts produced by the double neutron star and the black hole neutron star mergers, it'd be interesting to see if they lie some with beyond their host galaxy. That would be one of the predictions that we can make, is we think, if we engine people know anything at all, that the short duration bursts are the double neutron star and the black hole neutron star mergers. If we're right on that with our class of gamma ray bursts, then we believe that these guys should have some of their bursts occurring outside of their host galaxy. If, barring any unforeseen observational effect, we actually can get a sample and see that these guys are all within their host galaxy as well, then it's back to the drawing board for us. I think we'll overcome it fairly quickly because we're theorists after all. But I think it would be something that changes the theory. If they're outside, you know, we find some that are outside the host galaxy, that would make us, at least make me feel a lot better about this class of models, and I think it has a much better chance of working. And I think I'll stop there, not mentioning iron lines, but if you want, I can say something about iron lines.
Yeah, what was the, I mean, what do your blast and fireball people say about explosions in the intergalactic medium? Would you ever see them?
Yeah, so this is the current fear. I haven't heard I haven't asked the fireball people yet what they would say they observe, but that's my current fear, is there some selection bias against observing these bursts that are outside of their host galaxies, because they don't have anything to run into.
So the optical micro.
Yeah, because the optical is usually, the late time optical is usually the interaction with the intergalactic medium of this burst.
So that's the X-ray and the radio, unfortunately.
Yeah. So everything except for the gamma rays. Yeah, except for the gamma rays. So you know, maybe they're.
The next generation gamma ray telescope that gives you sub-arcsecond positions will probably be needed.
Yeah.
Gamma rays.
It would be worth, I didn't ask Peter this, it would be worth pushing Peter to make a statement on this before, you know, just to see what, first of all, to see if the fireball people can make a prediction that actually before the observation comes out, and then see what the.
I mean, your line is, we should say that these are the models like winds from the progenitors that they might run into.
Well, you can do that with the collapsar model, but the Durban neutron star model is going to be gone from its progenitor site before. So that one doesn't help. And the collapsar model is stuck in its star formation center anyway. But that is one thing that has helped the collapsar model and the helium merger model, is that there's predictions of some of these bursts, and I don't know how much this is still believed, but there was a big push at one point to say, oh, it looks like the burst is going through a wind, a wind environment. And that would say, oh, well, it has to be a massive star then. So that's some fuel for the collapsar helium merger progenitor.
You think the collapsar model is more likely than others?
Well, I have to say that I like the helium merger model first and best, but that's because I helped co-author that model, and collapsar model Stan came up with in 1993 or something. So. I think for the long duration bursts, the double neutron stars and the black hole neutron star models aren't going to work. So I think it's hard to get them to work in the long duration bursts. And that's what we want the collapsar and the helium merger model for.
From the observed high mass X-ray binaries, the number of them in our galaxy, it can, and also from the orbital characteristics. So if you ignore that for the moment, population synthesis, but just take the ones we observe, and you start from there, I think you will predict quite a number of cases where the neutron star merges completely with the massive star, because the orbits are rather narrow and so there's not enough energy in the orbit to throw up the envelope. So those would produce something like your helium star merger. The white high mass X-ray binaries, they may not merge, so they would produce binaries with helium star and neutron star.
It forms one of those two, yeah.
Yes, but I think from the observed characteristics, we have now, I think, certainly more than 50 B emission X-ray binaries, and we have quite a number of the others. I think, ignoring just the whole population synthesis, you could already make some predictions using these observed systems. And my hunch is that you get far too many of these
objects
that
would
produce
gamma. We could try it. It may be something where I think it's hard to get far too many. I mean, again, there's lots of ways of making it so we wouldn't see.
Yeah, you always can kick them.
These darn kicks. If these observers would tell us something about kicks, we would. Because the theorists certainly aren't going to say anything. So
I don't think the kicks would do more than harm than 50% or so. So it's not a big effect. I mean, if they kick a randomly distributed in direction, half of the systems are kicked closer, more closely bound, so the kicks don't help very much.
We should discuss this, because if you can make, get, well, if we can predict a rate at all, I would be happy. So whether it's higher or lower, you know, whatever, it would be nice to see if we can do something more accurately than what we're limited by.
More accurately than just from the first place.
Because you avoid some of the uncertainties because you start at a later state. So yeah, it would be worth, we should discuss this.
Great. Thanks again.